From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Arun Roth. This episode, President Obama announced he would make it legal for employees to talk about how much they earn. The thing is, it's already legal.
Talking about your own and your coworkers' pay among yourselves, the employer is not allowed to simply declare that to be confidential information.
In the world of sports, an organization works to promote tolerance.
Our goal is to shut down. From day one, our goal has been that we are not needed.
And rock legends Amy Mann and Ted Leo team up for The Both. That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. Google Maps, the highest profile map maker in the world today, took nearly a month to decide what to do with the changing border in Crimea. On Thursday, the company finally updated its maps to reflect a new reality, or should I say, several new realities. I asked John Gravois of Pacific Standard magazine to explain what users can expect to see.
Well, it depends on where you are or what version of Google Maps you're looking at.
What do you mean?
If you're here in the U.S. and you look at Google Maps, you will see a dotted line separating Crimea from the rest of Ukraine, which is how Google represents a disputed border. If you're in Russia, though, you'll see what Vladimir Putin wants you to see. You'll see a solid line dividing Ukraine from Crimea and no line between Crimea and Russia. So the map in Russia shows Crimea as part of Russia. The map here shows it as a disputed territory.
And what about in Ukraine?
In Ukraine, I think it shows it as still part of Ukraine.
So Google basically recognizes where the map request is coming from and then specifies which map it's going to return based on that?
You know, when people say, what does Google Maps say about a geographical conflict, it's really important to say, which Google Maps are you talking about? Because Google maintains different versions of their mapping platform in different countries. Last time I counted, there were over 30. That's partly because those mapping platforms are run out of servers that are located in countries that have their own laws about how the world needs to be represented politically. In China, there's a territory that India and China both claim. In China, that territory, called Arunachal Pradesh, looks like part of China because Chinese law says it is. And Google has servers in China that have to obey Chinese law.
What does Google say about this?
Google says a lot of things about their approach to map making that are frustrating and challenging for people who are used to a sort of traditional notion of maps as a single authoritative view of the world.
You know, right.
Historically, the most powerful mapmaker in the world was often the most powerful country in the world. It was the British Empire. And the mapmaker would come in and kind of settle disputes by saying, the name of that lake is X, what you people on the eastern shore of the lake call it. And so, sorry, you people on the western shore of the lake. Google doesn't have to settle those disputes because they can just represent way more information than a traditional paper map. Google can take something like the Persian Gulf / Arabian Gulf. The Arab countries on one side of that Gulf like to call it the Arabian Gulf. Iran has for thousands of years called it the Persian Gulf. And historically, most mapmakers have called it the Persian Gulf. But Google represents both names and in the process infuriates Iranians.
Well, it might be hard to believe, but I know there are still some other mapmakers around. I mean, Rand McNally springs to mind. What are those others doing?
It's been interesting. There's a big spread of the way that people have responded to this. National Geographic has done a sort of a version of what Google's done, and they did it quicker. They decided that they were going to show Crimea as a special case, a sort of disputed territory. So they note the border, but they shade Crimea differently from the rest of Russia or Ukraine. Huh. Rand McNally, though, they say they take their cues from the State Department. And, you know, the U.S. government still says that this is a land grab.
That's John Gravois of the magazine Pacific Standard. Thanks, John.
My pleasure.
The war in Syria has created a massive humanitarian crisis, rippling out from the conflict zones inside Syria to the refugee camps across the country's borders. Now an additional threat is looming. The United Nations World Food Program reported this past week that a bad drought in the area might significantly lower the harvest in Syria. We reached out to Dina El-Kassaby. She's a public information officer for the World Food Program. She's based in Amman, Jordan. And she described the already difficult process of getting food to the millions of people in refugee camps and behind battle lines.
The World Food Program moves around 40,000 tons of food each month across Syria. So this involves over 3,000 trucks navigating through checkpoints controlled by the government, controlled by armed groups. So insecurity is definitely our greatest challenge inside the country, and access to people in areas that are besieged or cut off. We need access to people on a constant basis to be able to assess the ongoing needs and to be able to reach them every month and deliver food, because food, unlike other things like blankets or mattresses, needs to be replenished every month once it's consumed.
As if things weren't bad enough, there is a report out this week from the UN warning that a bad drought could significantly reduce how much food will be grown inside Syria this year. If the situation is already dire, how much worse could it get?
The impact of a looming drought hitting particularly the northwest of the country, which is mainly Aleppo, Idlib, and Hama, which are some of the main agricultural areas in the country, could potentially push thousands more or millions more into food insecurity. The signs that we're seeing now are very similar to what we saw in 2008 when a major drought hit Syria. And many people that were affected by that drought actually didn't have time to recover before they were hit by the impact of fighting.
You know, Dina, this conflict in Syria is so immense, it can be really hard to wrap your head around it. Could you put a human face on what people are going through there?
Actually, just about a month ago, I was in Qamishli in northeast Syria, where food needs are massive. Displacement is beyond what you can imagine. And I actually visited a shelter, which was once a school. And I visited a woman called Hasna, who was living in a classroom with five other families. She has 10 children of her own. She's lost her husband. And she was telling me that the last time she received food assistance was 8 months ago. So I asked her, okay, so without food assistance, how do you survive and how do you feed your children? And she told me that she has to wake up in the morning and decide, do I feed my children today or do I save this food for tomorrow? The luxury that we have in the West as privileged people who take the fact that we have a meal every day for granted is something that really puts into perspective the suffering of people who have been displaced, who have lost everything and are really just surviving day to day.
I know the World Food Program relies on voluntary donations from the international community. Do you have enough support to provide all this aid that's needed there?
This is the largest operation that the World Food Program is running today. It is the most complex. It costs $41 million a week to meet the food needs of people affected by the conflict in Syria. We, of course, are running basically a hand-to-mouth operation. The minute that funds come in, they're immediately spent on food and spent on the operation. We rely on valuable donors like, the United States, Canada, Europe. But this is a massive crisis, and it requires a global response. So we hope that non-traditional donors will come forward and provide assistance and support, and including individuals like you and me. We can donate online and help alleviate the suffering of Syrians who have lost everything.
Dina El-Kassaby is a public information officer for the UN's World Food Program, and she spoke with us from Amman, Jordan. Dina, thank you so much and best wishes.
Thank you.
Working women back here in America make less money than men. It's what's known as the wage gap. The size of that gap is a matter of some debate, but several studies over many decades have confirmed the basic point. This past week, President Obama used the power of his office to try to narrow the gap, at least for one slice of the American workforce. He picked a fight with a practice known as pay secrecy.
First, I'm going to sign an executive order to create more pay transparency by prohibiting federal contractors from retaliating against employees who discuss their pay with each other.
Right. The hope is that if women know that their male colleagues are making more for equal work, they can do something about it. This order only applies to federal contractors, but here's the thing. Under federal law, with few exceptions, you already have the right to talk about your salary. We called up Cynthia Estlund. She's a professor at New York University's School of Law, and she says employees have had this right for nearly 80 years.
Since 1935, the National Labor Relations Act has provided that private sector employees basically have a right to engage in concerted activity for mutual aid or protection. That's, you know, old-fashioned sounding language maybe, but among other things, it means that you and your coworkers get to talk together about things that matter to you at work. So the National Labor Relations Board has long held that these pay secrecy policies that many employers have in writing violate the National Labor Relations Act.
What if I sign a contract that has a non-disclosure agreement attached to it? Then I'm not protected, right?
That's a really good example of some limitations on this policy. Employers do have some legitimate interests in confidentiality, and so trade secrets, for example, can be protected. People whose job it is to deal with other people's pay information, they can be prohibited from disclosing information. But talking about your own and your coworkers' pay among yourselves, the employer is not allowed to simply declare that to be confidential information and prohibit employees from talking about it.
So in other words, HR can't go around and tell everybody what you make, but you can.
Exactly.
How common is it for employers to flout this law and tell employees that they can't talk about it?
Well, I've seen some studies that suggest maybe 40% of employers actually have policies prohibiting employees from discussing each other's pay.
40%?
Something like that. Now, I don't know for sure if that's 40% have it on paper, because sometimes employers have what are called pay secrecy norms. So you find if you start talking about it, you might get a nudge from the boss saying, we don't do that around here. That's also unlawful under the National Labor Relations Act.
What protection do you have then while you are trying to fight a policy like this? I mean, if we're giving a hypothetical, say I'm talking with my fellow employees and my boss finds out and reprimands me, what do I do?
Technically, you could go to the National Labor Relations Board, which has many regional offices throughout the country, and you can file a charge online and complain about it. Unfortunately, it doesn't cost very much to violate the NLRA in most cases, and so employers aren't so afraid of violating it. But in principle, the fact that you can get a remedy down the line is supposed to deter the employer from engaging in this misconduct, and it's supposed to encourage employers to internalize these rules.
Given that the law is already on the books and it's pretty clear cut, why do you think the president signed this executive order this week?
Well, I think as we've discussed, the National Labor Relations Act it's not really well understood. People don't know much about it and it's under enforced. The penalties are not very serious. What this executive order does that the labor law doesn't is it provides a potentially very scary sanction.
What is that sanction?
Well, it says that we don't want to deal with contractors who engage in this sort of conduct. Even a very remote threat that you'll lose your federal contract is a very big, you know, worry compared to the worry that sometime down the line you might be given a slap on the wrist and told not to do this anymore, and maybe you have to reinstate someone if you fired them.
Cynthia Estlund is a professor at New York University's School of Law. Professor Estlund, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
As Professor Estlund says, pay secrecy policies plainly violate federal law, but that hasn't stopped some companies from firing employees for talking about their salaries. People like Lynn Teer. Back in 2011, she was working for a civil engineering company in Houston. Teer says she had a conversation with someone who was interested in working there, and they talked about salaries. Shortly thereafter, the bosses asked Teer to swing by.
The HR manager was there with her little brown envelope, and they said, "You've been discussing salaries." I said, "Excuse me?" And, yeah, and that's not allowed.
The HR manager told Teer that salary discussions were not allowed and fired her. And at the time, she didn't know the pay secrecy policy was illegal.
Did not know that. Mm-mm.
Neither did the bosses.
This is the funniest part. They didn't even know about the law themselves.
But her husband did know, and so Teer called up the NLRB and filed a complaint. After about 2 years of legal wrangling, she won her case along with a big check for back pay, plus the option of getting her old job back. She didn't take them up on that last part. Regardless of the law, keeping salary information private is getting harder and harder these days, especially with websites out there like Glassdoor.com.
So we're kind of like the Yelp for jobs and companies, and this is where employees go, share information that once was deemed taboo, and it's all about workplace transparency.
That's Scott Dabrowski. He's a career trends analyst at Glassdoor. It's a website that collects employee reviews of companies and CEOs and invites people to post salary information anonymously for anyone and everyone to see. You guys ever hear from employers who are a little miffed at what you do and the information that you're putting out there?
Absolutely. Employers are very curious as to what is going on Glassdoor. And
very
actually...
curious. Is that's how you put it?
Yeah, that's how I put it. Look, the truth is transparency has come a long way in 6 years. So when we did launch, we got the questions all the time. What is this? You're exposing my information. How dare you? I want this down. What we've seen now is employers actually understanding that, hey, this is actually where good employees, potential employees, are already inherently interested in researching your company.
In other words, transparency is coming even when it comes to salaries. And if employers can't beat them, they might as well join them. This week, yet another barrier fell for gay athletes. Just weeks after finishing his sophomore season at the University of Massachusetts, Derek Gordon became the first openly gay player in Division I men's college basketball. Gordon told his parents in March, his coach and teammates last week, but more than a year ago, he told people at an organization called You Can Play. It's the same group that helped University of Missouri defensive end Michael Sam when he came out a couple of months ago.
We try and pride ourselves on being almost like a Walmart, one-stop shopping for all your LGBT sports needs.
That's Patrick Burke, one of the founders of You Can Play. The nonprofit works with teams and players in all kinds of situations. Athletes who want to come out publicly, straight players with questions about having a gay teammate, schools looking for help with diversity seminars, and more. Part of the reason You Can Play has been so successful is its proximity to pro sports. Patrick Burke is the director of player safety for the National Hockey League. His dad, Brian, has been a high-profile NHL executive for decades. I talked with both of them this week. Brian Burke explained to us that the organization started as a tribute to his son and Patrick's brother, Brendan Burke, a high school athlete who came out back in 2009.
It was a national news story because at the time his father was the general manager of the Toronto Maple Leafs.
That being you.
That was me. And we lost Brendan tragically in a car accident later that year in the hockey season. And then Patrick really came up with this idea and put it together to commemorate and really celebrate all that Brendan had accomplished. So I'll turn it over to Patrick.
Yeah, I think what Brendan stood for was the idea that sports is a welcoming community that needs to do a better job welcoming the LGBT community. And the one thing that's great about sports is that it's a tremendous equalizer, except in terms of talent. All that matters is how good you are, how hard you've worked, how much preparation you've put in, how naturally talented you are. And the other things that divide us in society, whether it's your sexual orientation, your gender identity, your race, your religion, your, any of the thousands of other labels that people like to put on each other, none of that matters. So our motto is, if you can play, you can play.
Patrick, why was it important to you to start an organization like this?
My brother was my best friend. He was the person I was closest to in this world and someone I cared about very deeply. So when he left hockey as a senior in high school, we had gone to the same high school. We were 5 years apart, and I had been a player on the varsity team. And I never did anything to change the culture in that locker room. I never knew what effect homophobic slurs had on teammates. I never knew that there was a problem with my language. And 5 years later, Brendan didn't feel safe in that locker room. And I've always regretted the fact that I didn't know better at the time, that I didn't create a safer space for my younger brother to stay in the game. I think it's my responsibility and our responsibility as an organization to make up for that and make the sports world welcoming, not just in that one hockey locker room, but in every locker room at every level.
What do you do when an athlete gets in touch with you?
Most of what I do personally is a behind-the-scenes thing. But as an organization, first and foremost is taking care of the athlete's needs, making sure that he or she is prepared for what's coming. There are a lot of people who think they want to go public, and then they see exactly what it entails, and they decide not to. There are a lot of people who think, you know, I really want to work with LGBT youth, and then it turns out they're really bad with kids. There are a lot of people who say they're going to come out to their team, and then they have a horrible coming out experience at home and never come out to their team. So the first thing that we do is prioritize the athlete. These are human beings. It's not just a story. It's not just a media flash for us. It's, you know, Derek Gordon is a 22-year-old kid who is still growing up. He's still in college, and he still needs a lot of guidance. So we work with them to get them ready. We coordinate the media launch. We coordinate media outlets. We work with the team, the coaches, in this case, the athletic department at UMass, to make sure that everyone is ready, prepared, and well-spoken when this comes up.
It seems like maybe we're reaching some sort of critical mass at this point, even though there have only been, maybe half a dozen announcements recently. But they have been very high profile. Jason Collins of the NBA, Michael Sam, Derek Gordon. I wonder, Brian, do you think we are getting to the point where this is no big deal?
Yes, I do. We're not there yet, but I told this story when I gave a speech last week. There were 3,000 kids in my high school, and not one of them was gay. Well, of course, a scat of them were gay.
Right.
But back then, in 1970, if you were a male and came out as gay, you were at significant risk. Mm. And so there were no gay students. And you compare that to now, the progress we've made, you know, the LGBT community has made in that time. But I don't think it's any greater than women have made in that time and people of color have made in that time. And, you know, biases and ignorance and attitudes of fear, they're not doors that are kicked in. They are walls that crumble over time. Time is the greatest ally as we fight this prejudice and this bigotry. And, yes, I hope there's a day test when we're talking about hockey on this show and not athletes coming out. I do think the pioneers deserve credit. I do think the Sams and the Collinses, I think those men deserve great credit for the courage they've displayed, but the acceptance they've received and the warm welcome they've gotten from the public, I think that's what's paving the way for the next group of athletes to not require so much courage.
Yeah. Patrick, what is your hope for the future of your organization?
Our goal is to shut down. From day one, our goal has been that we are not needed. All of us have careers outside of this. All of us have hopes and dreams that go beyond advocacy work. Our goal is that we get to a point in the sports world where this type of education is no longer needed. I don't know what that timeline is. If you had asked me 2 years ago when we launched, I would have said about a decade. Now I think it might even be less. What we want is to get to the point where athletes like Jason Collins or Robbie Rogers or Brittany Griner bringing their partner to the rink or to the game, and it's just seen as entirely and completely normal. And once we get there, we know we've done a good job.
That's Patrick Burke. He's the president of You Can Play, and he joined us with his father, Brian Burke, who is the president of hockey operations for the Calgary Flames. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tess. Thanks for having us on. It's important stuff.
Now for the latest installment of our series, My Big Break, about triumphs big and small. Autumn Earhart, a sales rep in Orange County, California, landed her big break when she was a contestant on her favorite game show, Wheel of Fortune.
I grew up watching it with my dad ever since I could probably read, and we'd always have competitions, who could solve it faster, and I was always told growing up, you should try out. And I was like, there's thousands upon thousands of people that try out. There's no way I'll ever get on. And for some reason, I just decided I'm going to do it. And I was 30 years old, and it turns out that they're having their 30th anniversary, and they were looking for people that had something to do that involved being 30. And I just got lucky. Once I got on stage and they were getting ready to film me, I was just shaking and sweating, and I was one person over from the host, Pat Sajak. It's completely different when you're in the studio with the audience and lights and cameras in your face, but you just try to do your best and get in the zone and kind of pretend like you're playing at home.
This young lady is having a heck of a night so far. You see that she has that...
The bonus round comes, and I introduce my parents on the stage and my fiancé. They were all there to watch.
That's my dad, Harold, my mom, Francine, and my fiancé, Joey.
All right, well, they are all pulling for you, and we all are, and we're going to ask you now, spin it.
I spin the wheel, then my category goes up, and it was...
Thing.
A thing?
R-S-T-L-N-E, Vanna will...
They give you the letters R-S-T-L-N-E, and only the T's come up, and one R. So I was like, oh, man. So I guess my letters, which I believe were C, D, M, and an A... Since I had that wild card, I ended up guessing a G. And thank goodness for that wild card, because C, D, M, and A were not in that puzzle. The only letter I got was a G.
Let's get him up there, Vanna. Anything?
And I was like, just one.
Oh, no.
Oh, boy. Well, this looks challenging.
With the T and the G in the first word, I pretty much figured out that it was tough. And me being a workout junkie that I am, somehow workout popped in my head. And so the timer started.
Tough workout.
What?
And then all of a sudden, streamers come down. And he opened the envelope, and it said $1 million.
We have a $1 million winner.
I was just completely shocked. I couldn't even describe in words. I couldn't even speak anymore. I could barely breathe. You know, I thought I would cry or something like that, but I think I had so many emotions going on that I was, like, almost frozen. My family had run out, and we were all hugging. My dad didn't even realize I had won $1 million. And I'm still shocked. It's been... almost a year since it aired, and I'm still like, did this really happen? Not in a million years would I have thought that I would have been on the show, let alone win a million. This was my big break.
That was Autumn Earhart, the second contestant on Wheel of Fortune to ever win $1 million. She's saving it for her upcoming wedding, and yes, the engagement came before the $1 million. We want to hear your story. Send us an email at mybigbreak@npr.org. Most Americans have no idea what life in Cuba is really like. If they have any notion, it's probably of Cuba under Fidel Castro. But Castro ceded authority to his brother Raul in 2006, and Raul officially became president in 2008. The intervening years have brought immense change to the island nation, change that Julia Cook witnessed firsthand. The Portland, Oregon native first traveled to Cuba as a college student in 2003, and it so captured her that she returned in 2008 and began a 5-year chronicling of post-Fidel society. Her new book is The Other Side of Paradise, Life in the New Cuba. I asked her what pulled her back again and again.
I wanted to go back because I had studied there, and I felt that the generation that I'd gotten to know when I was 20 in 2004 at the University of Havana functioned very differently from the way that I had thought that Cubans would function. The media situation here with Cuba is primarily dominated by politics and clichés, I think, and I think actually daily life is much more interesting than I had been led to believe. And so I wanted to go back, especially on the verge of this cataclysmic change that was starting to happen, the departure of Fidel from the scene into the background, and find out how things actually functioned.
One of the things you write about is how hard it is to understand the most basic parts of the Cuban economy as an outsider, that there are these layers upon layers of markets for every commodity. Can you try to explain that for us? Give us a sense of what that's like?
Oh, in order to get any simple commodity, you have to figure out who's selling it and who needs to be buying it. So it's just a matter of spending a lot of time and asking a lot of questions. I think that was one of the things that I enjoyed most about being in Cuba, was the almost childlike position that it put me in. I had to ask so many questions and be so prepared to have everything, all of my preconceived notions blown out of the water. Things as simple as where to buy fish. You're on an island. You think there should be fish everywhere, and there aren't.
I was particularly struck by your descriptions of the black market there. I mean, you were able to get things like Serrano ham and Parmesan cheese, but not through traditional methods.
Not at all. I remember it was one of the most thrilling moments. It was a moment when I felt like I had really, like I meant something to someone in Cuba, when a friend of mine, an artist friend, gave me the phone number of his black market food provider, because that's kind of a dangerous thing. The black market food providers are obviously functioning illegally, and it meant that he trusted me, first of all, and it also meant that he cared about me enough to provide more demand for the thing that he also wanted, which could potentially drive up the prices of these items on the island. So I called him, and I was like, "What do you have?" And he was like, "I got blue cheese, I got Parmesan, I've got Serrano ham, I got smoked salmon." And he rattled off this list, and I was like, "I want Serrano ham, I want Parmesan cheese, and I want smoked salmon." And he just showed up the next day with this big bag full of stuff, and I paid him.
You were able to travel back and forth from this country that is cut off to most Americans, and that's because you went to and from Mexico City. Talk to us a little bit about what that's like, because you were basically off the grid. I mean, you weren't there in any official capacity. You had to do transactions, you know, practically in an alleyway. I mean, this was not a lot of stuff that you could do out in public. How did you manage over those 5 years?
It was stressful. I was there on a tourist and then a student visa, and I didn't want to get a journalist's visa because I was the journalists that I'd known that had gotten journalist visas from Mexico City were coddled. They were given permission to do certain things. They were very much on the grid in Cuba. I didn't want that for myself. I wanted to be able to interview who I wanted to be able to interview, but that meant that I was constantly afraid of being asked to leave.
What kind of risk was there for you, and not just you, but the people who you were dealing with?
I worried about that a lot. The people that I was dealing with, I worried that they would face some kind of issue for talking to me. The risk to me was pretty low. I would have just been asked to leave the country, compared to what some Americans actually do in Cuba, distributing satellite equipment or doing other covert type operations. What I was doing was pretty innocuous. But yeah, I worried a lot about my sources. I worried that they would have trouble getting jobs or that they would face some kind of problem from the government. I haven't heard of anything. No one that I've interviewed has had trouble leaving the country because of me. Luckily, that would have broken my heart. I'm glad. And I think that reflects a profound change in the way that Cuba is dealing with the idea of openness. When you walk around and if you want to talk to someone about their government, people nowadays speak quite freely, and that was not always the case.
What do you think our most outdated and inaccurate vision is of Cuba?
I think it's twofold. I think, first of all, so many Americans, I've gotten so many comments recently that people are surprised to hear that Cubans don't hate Americans. And, you know, Cubans, I never met a Cuban who didn't have a family member of some sort who was living abroad. So Cubans are a much more sophisticated bunch than I think many Americans think they are. And there is zero animosity on the part of the Cuban people toward the American people. I think that's one really unique thing about Cuba is that contemporary Cuba is very cognizant of how detached politics is from life. And they're completely, it's second nature to them to say, "Your government stinks, but come on in and have a run with me."
Julia Cook's new book is called The Other Side of Paradise, Life in the New Cuba. Julia, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Tess.
Famous songwriting teams used to put pencil to music paper in small offices at the Brill Building or find their voice while gigging around Liverpool. Today, they don't even have to live in the same time zone, and they can even inspire each other through 140 characters or less. Anytime you establish a world of your own, Veteran singer-songwriters Amy Mann and Ted Leo call L.A. and New York home, respectively. But they bonded over Twitter, and their followers got to watch as their mutual admiration blossomed into a partnership. Their combined talents are now known as The Both. But even you can't help me now. You can't help. You can't help me now. As writers, both Mann and Leo are known for their heavy subject matter. But every once in a while, on this album and on stage, another side shines through. They're both really funny. The first song they wrote together became a bizarre first video. It's about an encounter they had on a tour stop in Milwaukee. They'd stumbled upon that city's tribute to Arthur Fonzarelli, a statue locals call the Bronze Fonz.
First of all, of course, we were like, oh, we got to take a picture with it. But none of the pictures we took, they were all kind of horrifying, and we couldn't figure out why, so we became sort of obsessed with the Bronze Fonz.
Are you familiar with the Uncanny Valley?
No.
Concept? It's, you know, when something is almost too realistic, but like just shy in a way that is very creepy, like with a lot of kind of virtual reality images and robots and things like that.
Just off a little bit.
Yeah, just enough to make it deeply unsettling. And I think that this particular piece of public art captures that really well.
I started writing about this day that we had walked around and seen the Bronze Fonz, and also there was a big bronze duck, which was also bizarre because it was twice the size of a real duck, and we didn't understand why that was so big, but the Fonz is so small. And so kind of as a joke, I'd said these lyrics, and then we sort of became attached to them, so we made it into a real song.
Yeah, we had the discussion, can we keep these lyrics in, and I think we decided not only can we, but we must.
Let's get into your collaborative process here. Ted, you tend to write some pretty muscular songs. Amy, yours can be a little more delicate. I know I'm oversimplifying your work, but how did you go about finding a middle ground as you were writing the songs, as you were figuring out how to put this album together?
Well, we'd spent enough time with each other on the road, listening to each other's music, talking about it, getting inside each other's heads, that when we began to work together, there was a natural back and forth without either of us, you know, being required to push or pull, that, you know, hopefully met somewhere in the middle, not by consensus, but as, you know, as a truly kind of new thing of its own.
Yeah, it wasn't a strain. I mean, I made an effort to, when it was me coming up with sort of initial stems for songs, I made an effort to try to absorb a little of Ted's style and write a bit more in that manner. But it wasn't that it was necessarily outside of my style. It's just it's outside of my style of singing. That's the only problem. It's like I just can't really deliver a lot of energy or aggression in my vocal. But, you know, with this, it's fine because I have Ted to do that. The contract's a joke, but when you see smoke, you run toward the fire because you must. And they all called your name when the crash finally came and left you to pick up the dust. I saw you walking in silence down to the bridge, but nothing went over the side. So I guess to someone with your heritage, withdrawal like consent is implied. And it's true. I'm speaking with Ted Leo and Amy Mann. Their first album together is coming out on Tuesday. It's called The Both. That's also the name of their band. I'm going to ask you each the same question. And Amy, tell me something on this album that only Ted Leo could have written. Well, No Sir to Me is a perfect example because the... That's a song that the initial verse was an idea that I had come up with. There's a shadow in the wind. And then Ted takes it into a sort of chorusy bridge thing, which first of all is already really interesting form-wise, but harmonically takes it into a place that is so perfect and absolutely nothing that I would have ever thought of. And it's fluid when it turns into steam, you walk through it. Even when you don't scream, you get to it. There's a way and there's no way. You won't make it there alone. Where that chord progression goes, how it sort of climbs this weird hill of modulation and then modulates back down. It's so interesting and odd and perfect and sophisticated and sort of raw all at the same time. That is very Ted Leo to me.
All right, Ted, what's something that only Amy Mann could have written?
You know, I actually am also going to take No Sir as an example. I think, you know, as hearing Amy talk about it just then, I'm realizing how that really illustrates, I think, what we do and how we work together, because what she just described of where I took the song, I would never have been able to do without the platform that she presented me of the kind of, you know, first couple of verses and chorus. I don't think I would have thought to write that kind of soulful, you know, 6/8 waltzy rock ballad, and the spooky atmosphere that she lays out at the beginning of it is something that I love, and it actually remains kind of my favorite song on the album. Work on your story, sir. Are you wearing her? Moon's gonna waver and change. And I think this is an example of where I feel working with Amy actually pushes me to heights of my own that I have not achieved by myself, because there's no way I would have begun a song that way, let alone taken it, you know, where it went. And, you know, I have her obviously to thank for starting it. Yeah, yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah, yeah. That's Amy Mann and Ted Leo. Together they are The Both. Their first album, Together, comes out on Tuesday. But if you'd like to give it a listen, every track is at our website right now, as well as their Tiny Desk concert. That's at nprmusic.org. Ted, Amy, thank you so much. It's been fun.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Week ending April 13th, 2014, that is the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West. It's the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, and Daniel Hajek. Our intern is Stephen Jackson. Patrick Murray is out. Marcia Caldwell and Leo Delagula are standing in as technical directors. Mathoni Maturi is senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is senior producer. I'm Tess Vigeland, in for Arun Roth. We'll be back next week. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.